Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and I believe that today we could say we're having a baking program.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, one of the really good interviews at the end is all about nuts, but nuts going to baking anyway.
Yeah, well, it has things to do with nuts.
That's what I sort of think of when I think of nuts as much as anything else. I think about baking.
Right.
So that's why we put them all together.
And we start with Nick Malgeri, who is the most prolific cookbook writer I've ever encountered, I think. I think he gets one published a year. And this one is a little bit specialized. It's called Pastry.
And the wonderful part about it is that, I mean, he's a great guy. I mean, he's absolutely on top of his profession.
As a
pastry chef. But he admitted at the beginning of the interview that he never was much good at pastry.
Yeah, that was true. And but he was very good at pastry.
Yeah, so the book was sort of a kind of a journey in making sure that he really understood how it was done and making sure that he really did understand it and he really was good at it so he could go on and explain it to people. But he started out from the same position I would and the same position, Anne, I guess you do, coming that pastry is really rather frightening and something we never really conquered.
Well, he has it conquered, and you get this book and you will too. Nick Malgeri is the director of the baking program at the Institute of Culinary Education in New York City. And I just noted in the back of the book that you are now the author of 12 cookbooks.
That's right. I got to do something to stay out of trouble.
Oh, my goodness. But this current one I've gotten so many baking books recently, but this is not like a baking book. It's called Nick Malgeri's Pastry, Foolproof Recipes for the Home Cook, and it's as much about savory as it is sweet, right?
Yeah, I have some savory recipes in there. There are some savory pies and tarts, quiche and things of that nature. And in both the puff pastry and also the chapters of yeast risen pastries, there are some savory recipes.
Yeah, those pizza recipes sound absolutely divine.
Yeah, they're not pizzas, though. They're pizza rustica, that kind of thing. So
that's
it's a savory
pie
rather than something flat like a focaccia or what we think of as a pizza.
But the most interesting thing is the admission you make at the beginning of the book that says, I was always a failure at making pastry.
Oh, I am.
Yes, yeah. Well, that's when I was trying to teach myself how to do it, and I was following all of the current lore about making pastry. Don't handle it too much. Don't this, don't that, don't that. Everything was phrased as a negative, you know? Don't. And that's not the way to learn how to do anything. The way to teach somebody how to do anything is to tell them what to do, not what not to do. I've tried to do that. I've also tried to do a bunch of recipes that are really easy for beginners to do. I've had a lot of luck in the past few years in using a dough that's made with olive oil for savory pastries. And I said to myself, well, might also be just as easy and just as good to make a sweet dough using oil. And I decided not to use olive oil for that. I use a good kind of very neutral flavored vegetable oil, like a cold pressed safflower oil. And that works really nicely. Those are two doughs that you don't have to worry if it's warm in the room. You don't have to worry if you've never had a rolling pin in your hand before. Both of those doughs are very easy to make, and you need all of the elaborate equipment of a bowl and a fork.
See, that's my style of baking.
Yeah, you know, you don't necessarily... It's great to have a fancy mixer. Who wouldn't like to have a beautiful KitchenAid mixer or a food processor? And I use those machines a lot too, but they don't have to be essential for you to be able to make a pie or a tart.
Well, that's good to know because, I've made one pie in my whole entire life, and it was a strawberry pie.
Ooh, and that sounds good.
Yeah, we were in Australia, and I couldn't find, my mother always made it with Crisco pie crust, which, yuck, of course, they had nothing. I know, but they had nothing even vaguely like that. They did have lard, but lard was on the no-no list at that time. I forget what I think I ended up using lard, but yeah. I had forgotten that she actually baked the pastry shell before putting in the soupy filling.
Well,
I pierced all the dough at the bottom of the pan. I pierced it all, then poured in this runny strawberry mix.
Oh, no, and that's
it was horrible.
That definitely would merit you at least a 3-year sentence in the pastry prison.
I think it was so boiled.
What she's not letting you know about is that she wanted to go to the Australian supermarket and buy frozen strawberries, and back then they had no such product. Now they probably do now, but in 1972 they had no such product on the shelves.
Yeah, I'll bet they had frozen passion fruit though to put on the pavlova.
Yeah, well, I made pavlova. I did all right with pavlova.
You don't freeze it. You just pick it off the vine in your garden.
You don't need to preserve it.
Now, here's a tribute from someone who can be very picky about whether or not people know their subject, but a man who has a dough recipe for Cornish pasties.
has to be my hero. And I struggled with that, and it's interesting because in the UK, they unabashedly use two different kinds of vegetable shortening. So I said, okay, yuck and yuck. And you know what? I've got to run back to the book and look at it. I know I used butter, and did I also use a little bit of oil in with that? I can't remember. And the one thing about the pasty dough, though, it's worked quite a bit. So, and it gets quite elastic. This is the important part of it. I said to myself, oh, no. I said, this dough, working it that much, I mean, it fully needs as much as a bread dough. I said, this dough is going to be too tough to eat. Well, you know what? I have to say, I must have done something right using that butter because the dough was really nice and tender and quite flaky. But, you know, it has to hold. You need a really strong dough to hold up, or else it's not going to hold together with all those meat juices and the vegetables and everything that are inside.
Now, the funny part about it is, you see, you made a home cook's mother and grandmother's Cornish pasty. The commercial ones you buy have hardly any meat in them.
They're all potatoes.
They're all potatoes and turnips.
Yeah, well, actually, you know what's happened nowadays, though? And it makes a big difference. You know what? I'm opening. Here we go. I'll find them in a minute. I opened the PDF of the last version of the book that I have. But, you know, Cornish pasties are, the name is now protected by law.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
UK, big time.
Which is why I called mine Cornish style pasties.
Right.
Here we go. 500 grams, so a little bit more than a, it's just butter. That's it. It's more than, a little more than a pound of flour, salt, only about 25% of the weight, less than 25% of the weight of flour in butter, and quite a bit of water. More water than butter. It makes a very, very elastic dough. But you know what? It eats very nicely, and it holds up to all those juices inside.
Now, you understand, you know the story about how they were designed.
Yeah, there's about 1,000 stories about pasties. Yeah.
Well,
people say it was the fishermen. Other people say it was the miners.
Yeah.
Then there's the story about the pasty having the jam on one side and the meat and potatoes on the other side.
That's disgusting.
So you started eating the meat and potatoes, you arrived at the jam. There's a problem with that, though, because that's really what how people used to make something called roly-poly pudding, which was a kind of suet dough that was pressed out and then with the filling rolled up like a jelly roll inside it.
Well, let's do a bit of a commercial about the book. So what is it that people are going to learn, problems that they have been having with pastry that they're going to be able to overcome as a result of buying this book and using it to squash the pastry dough?
That might help, you know that? Always use something good and even in weight and in smoothness to press out dough. But you know what? It's everything you want to know about working, making pastry doughs, working with them, and also making some things that are really good to eat. That's the whole point.
Yeah, your recipes themselves are interesting.
It's not an intellectual exercise. It's, it's making some stuff that is going to be really good and that you're going to enjoy.
You say foolproof recipes for the home cook. I take issue with your Turkish pistachio pastry.
Well, now, you know, that's right. The one that's on the cover, that's Havuç Dilimi Baklava. That is a very lovely and wonderful pastry to make and could cheat and use packaged phyllo dough. It's not as good as the dough you make yourself. But I always tell, that's one of the things I tell people, too, if you're a beginner, don't make the recipe that's on the cover.
you've got to get
a little bit of practice, experience, and also confidence under your belt before you do that.
Yeah, well, I once even made, what is the other thing that you use this, that kind of dough for? The,
I don't know, you used to make chocolate pies and rum cream pies.
Oh, no, I'm talking about
baklava,
with the phyllo. Those little triangle things, my mother and I made them once. Using even packaged the sheets. We made 200 of them for a party, and it was like Chinese water torture. I mean, it was like a nightmare, trying to keep everything moist so it didn't flake and crack. And
that's true.
I don't know that any Greeks even make their own phyllo anymore.
No, actually, the things for like the spinach pie and all of that, a lot of Greek home cooks use a dough that's very similar to the olive oil dough in my book. It's a little bit more wet than that dough. And they roll it out fairly thinly, but not as thin as packaged phyllo dough.
Uh-huh. Let's just mention some of these things, because it's not just that you have all these tips on pastry, which in itself would make an important book for somebody like me. But then you take it into all these interesting the dishes and recipes like feta and mint borek. I mean, that looks absolutely scrumptious.
That is. That's very, very good. And it has such an enormous quantity of mint in it. I kind of did. A friend of mine who lives in Istanbul gave me that recipe, and I did a double take when I saw the amount of mint. And I said, well, you know what? I'm going to try this. And I tried it for the first time using packaged yufka leaves, which you can buy at a Turkish import store, or in many Middle Eastern grocery stores. And I brought all the makings of it to a class one day, and we had a little bit of a lull toward the end of the class, and I said to everybody, I'm going to put this together very quickly. It's, I showed them the packaged dough and everything, and I'm going to throw it in the oven. I said, we're going to taste it. I said, no guarantees. I've never made it before. I have no idea how it's going to turn out. It was really funny. I took it out of the oven, and I cut some wedges for people to taste, and people were kind of leery to begin with, and the first person that tasted it shouted, this is fabulous! So, winner on my hands. It's interesting because in using the yufka dough, which is kind of like a great big circle of dough that's just made out of flour and water, and it's rolled out, it's not stretched, it's rolled out very thin. Instead of just moistening that with butter or oil like people do with phyllo dough, this has a mixture of butter and milk and water and eggs poured over it. And it doesn't make it custardy like a quiche, but what happens is that those layers of dough that are inside the pastry while it's baking kind of become soft and tender like cooked pasta. And the outside layers, of course, become crisp. So it's a really wonderful contrast in texture, too. Wow. Very unusual, and something that I had never experienced before, tasting it in Turkey.
Yeah, I've never heard of it. I mean, this is all new to me, but the what was I just looking at? Where did I go? Well, you have classics. I wanted to get that in so that people who want to make the classics, if they want to make
a brioche.
Yes,
I do. I have brioche and croissant.
Cookie
dough and sweet dough and flaky dough, all of those. And even though I didn't do an all-out apple pie or blueberry pie recipe, you can see, for example, or a pecan pie recipe, you can see in some of the recipes, for example, I have an apple and blueberry pie, which is a really great combination. I was amazed when I first tasted it.
Yeah.
And then as a variation of that, I have a plain blueberry pie.
Yeah, that's my favorite. I have an apple and cheddar pie,
and as a variation of that, I have a plain apple pie.
Well, the blueberry pie.
All the ones you're going to want to make for the upcoming holidays are there, too.
Well, my birthday is until July, but I have a blueberry pie on my birthday every year instead of a cake.
I don't blame you. I would love to have one.
Yeah. Just off the top of my head, why do you think all of a sudden, I mean, I'm sure you know that the James Beard Awards added a baker category this year. Why do you think there's such an interest that I was telling you about how many pastry books I got and baking books? Why all of a sudden is pastry chefs, bakers, why are they moving up on the celebrity level?
I don't know that it's all of a sudden. I mean, I think it's something that's been building for a long time. And the United States used to have a lot of bakeries in it. And for some reason, the time between the wars, things started diminishing already after World War One, and from then on, there were just less and less and less and less bakers and bakeries and just scratch baking going on.
But they
there's so many towns that you can go to, and people say, "Oh, you know, there used to be a dozen bakeries
exactly.
that made thus and such here." Like in St. Louis with the gooey butter cake and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And they just disappeared.
Why? People just got out of the habit of
having dessert.
I don't know.
I know in my childhood I remember so many bakeries in our neighborhood, both bread bakeries and Italian pastry shops. And
In
the neighborhood contiguous to where we lived, there were a half a dozen Jewish bakeries.
Uh-huh.
And those, those are all gone now.
Yeah.
I think it was the long hours. I think it was the working conditions. And I think it was back then people weren't willing to pay a premium price for high quality baked goods. So I think a lot of people just couldn't make, that it wasn't financially worthwhile for people to do it. And now when people are going into business doing it, again, things are a little bit more, of course, everything is more expensive now, but I think the prices that people can expect to be paid when they sell baked goods are a little bit more than they used to be. So it makes it practical for someone to be able to do that as a business.
That makes sense. My good friend Judy's mother made the most sublime Eastern European nut rolls. But the cost of the ingredients, there's no way she could do anything commercially with it. We did the same with my mother's scotch, which is a Swiss chard bread with cheese. And we priced out the ingredients, and there was no way you could sell anything that cost that. I mean, and you're competing with the mass commercial bakeries with the hostess things or whatever they are.
Sure. And that kind of stuff is not very good, but people buy it, and then they say, well, wait a minute, this costs $2, and you want me to pay $10 for that?
Exactly. I think you have to nail that.
But I think nowadays, certainly in larger cities, I think there are more bakeries coming,
Yeah, there are more artisanal types of bakers opening up. Yeah. Well, Nick Balgieri, you've done it again. And
thank you.
And congratulations also to your photographer, Romulo Yanes.
I know. Romulo Yanes and Paul Grimes, who did the food styling. They are both a pleasure to work with, and they're also consummate artists. I mean, they don't do anything that doesn't turn out beautiful.
Well, this is an absolutely delicious book. So
thank you. I'm thrilled with it myself. I'm very happy with the way things turned out.
Well, thank you very much, Nick, and we'll be crossing the big pond for the next installment right?
Yes.
Good. We should always do that. Because we know the English love their puddings and desserts and cakes, and Jane Hornby from over there certainly knows how to as well.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, as we said, if you're wanting to learn how to bake, trust Jane Hornby.
Trust British chefs generally, I guess.
Well, if you can't learn to bake after the step-by-step book that Jane Hornby's produced, you might as well throw in the towel and the rolling pin
I wanted to inject something here because over the many years of my life, I've heard a lot of people complain about the quality of British cuisine, but I've never heard anybody complain about the quality of British baked goods. And it's central to people's lives, you understand. So when I was a child growing up, we would go to my aunts and uncles frequently for special occasion dinners, and there would always be lots of desserts. And I was known as the young man who always went and had two of everything.
Yeah, well,
I don't do it as much as I used to, but I used to do it then, and there was a reason why, because everybody had the secret, and Jane Hornby's now going to share that secret with all of you. So pay attention.
Jane Hornby, this is the second time we've interviewed you, and the second book that just rings with such clarity. This current one is What to Bake and How to Bake It, and you promise that if anybody follows your instructions to the letter, they will have a successful outcome. Is that true?
I do. My hand on heart. Put an awful lot of work into making sure these recipes will work for anybody, no matter what your level of baking skill, from zero to experience. There's something there that I'm sure will give you great success in the kitchen.
Well, you're a perfectionist. I can say that, can't I?
Yes.
I mean, like, how many times do you test a recipe before it goes in the book?
Well, it can totally depend, but there are certain things I'm looking for. So not necessarily the testing so much as the development, which is, to me, the different thing. To me, testing is once a recipe is developed and complete, then it's tested in its entirety, but, you know, once through by me and then once through by somebody else. It's more the getting to that particular point of perfection for, you know, so I'm looking for the right rise and the right texture and the right colour and the right kind of crack along the top of the cake even. You know, if there's going to be a crack, it'll be perfect.
And, you say that about you like that, the cracking, right?
Yeah, I like a pound cake to have a crack down the middle. Maybe that's just me, but you know, there's certain things rise in certain ways, and I kind of have an idea of what they want to look like. And I think that might be because I'm a food stylist as well as a writer, so I've got a visual eye for things, particularly anyway.
You trained as a chef as well?
Yes, I trained as a chef. I trained back in my 20s at a beautiful place called Leeds School of Food in London. And so I've got all the technical know-how is there, but I've got to very much have an angle on home and how to apply that to home cooking and home cooks without it seeming daunting. That's the main aim.
Yeah, I'm one of those people that will not tackle a baking job. Peter said maybe your book will encourage me to bake a cake.
Yes, and is that just fear of it failing on you?
Well, I have had it fail on me. I made a pavlova once, one of the guests said it's the first pavlova she ever had where she had to eat it with a fork and a steak knife.
Excellent. Well, I think that a lot of people assume that you should be able to bake just by looking at a book, and it's like learning to drive. You didn't learn to drive in a day. Baking is a skill. It takes some time to accrue, learning different techniques and realizing that you've just made the best sponge cake or a perfect pavlova. But I think a lot of books, they give you so much technical information, you get bogged down. Perhaps you get lost in the key of actually what needed to be done in the recipe. And that's why the step-by-step nature of my cookbooks, a very kind of clear explanation and a need-to-know basis of information. I'm not telling you anything you don't need to know. Actually, I hope guides people to having a successful result. It's like I'm sort of teaching you as you go through. So by the time you've finished that one recipe and you've, fingers crossed, come out the oven and it looks beautiful, then you think, oh, I can tackle that now, and then you'll feel got some confidence and you can move on to the next thing.
And now Fiden puts out beautiful books, and this one is no exception. It's lovely. Thanks. Tell me a little bit about how you do this step by step.
How it differs to an ordinary recipe, perhaps.
I like this layout very much. First of all, the graphics are beautiful, but the cookies and then the bundt cake. Then you have each recipe, you lay out all the steps. I'm actually, before we even get to that, I'm looking at your layout for utensils and equipment.
Mm-hmm.
It's beautiful. It's a gorgeous graphic. And it's everything that anybody needs to know.
Yes. For anyone who, obviously, people can't see what we're talking about, it's a very clear picture, an overhead photograph of bowls, sieves, spatulas, wooden spoons. It's my kind of basic kitchen kit for someone who wants to bake. Everything is in the book. And I'm not saying you've got to start off and buy the whole lot in one go. There are some recipes that are so simple, all you need is a wooden spoon and a bowl and the pan you're going to bake it in. But these are the key things that will lead you to having ultimate success in a recipe. So very clear. And then the step-by-step photographs in the book. As I said, I sort of have to think visually, and especially when I write these books, they have to be extremely visual and very, very clear. So although the recipes aren't that dissimilar in their nature to a recipe I might write for somebody else, for a magazine, for example, I'm telling you absolutely everything that you could possibly come up against during that process. So a recipe for a sponge cake, instead of having three easy steps, or saying these three steps, we might make that into eight steps. And it's just the same recipe, and it's as easy. It's just really telling people what to look for in the bowl, what might happen here, why your eggs might split when you start adding to the butter and the sugar, what to look out for and how to counter that. So I'm hoping that every step of the way, it's like I'm there with you. And I work with the photographers for weeks on end doing this photography.
Whose idea was this overhead, which is brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was a collaboration between, which is called Fresh and Easy. It's the same way. We did that the same way as well. And it's proved to be a very, very successful format. I know step-by-step books aren't anything new, but I think the way that Fiden does it, the way we've done it, does look new and fresh. It's a contemporary, clean way to start your cooking journey.
And there's the touch of whimsy here too, like these cookies with a little gingerman, and it's just adorable.
That's one of my, I've got a few favourite shots in the book, and that's one of my favourites. I love the little faces. They're cute, aren't they? Yeah, I did allow to have a little bit of Jane here and there. It's one of these books where I've tried not to be too personal, because it's not actually about me, it's about you. It's about you as the cook, and I'm there to help you. But here and there, there's a few little touches that sort of put smiley faces and little daft things here and there.
Well, when you spell everything out, like certain rules, I mean, I don't want it to sound militant, but you say right up front, and it's absolutely the truth, is that measuring accurately is absolutely everything.
Yeah.
You can't get anywhere in baking if you do not measure accurately.
No, and some people like to rebel against that, and that's fine, but if you're not an experienced baker, you can't expect a recipe to work without measuring. In fact, I'm an experienced baker, and I wouldn't start a recipe without measuring. It's just not worth a heartache, because you pour a lot of love into a cake, don't you? You're normally making a cake for somebody else, in general. Uh-huh. And to have it fail on you just because you couldn't be bothered to level off the cup or measure the baking powder properly is just heartbreaking to me. So it's very, very important that you don't guess and you measure correctly. And there's a lot of time getting to grips with cups and sticks of butter, and I'm totally okay with all that. The whole book in the States is in cup measures, and in the UK and Europe we've got gram measures.
Oh, okay.
So did it both ways, and I cooked every cake both ways because I was determined that this is going to be right for everyone. So yes, good set of cup, reliable brand, good set of spoons, and just take your time. And my husband, Ross.
Oh, that's right. You just got back. Your publicist said you just got back from your honeymoon.
Yes.
Where did you go?
Where do we go? We went to Venice. But it was short and sweet because we had to get back for work.
And George Clooney, huh?
Yeah, you probably had to get out of town because George
Clooney
had all
the hotel. I know. They couldn't cope with both of us at once. I watched Ross, and we watched him make a cake a few weeks ago when we were doing some filming, and he literally was saying to me, do I scrape the top of the spoon or do I leave it mounded like this? And I said, well, what does the recipe say? And it says 1 teaspoon. I said, it doesn't say heaped teaspoon. He said, no. I said, okay, well, in that case, you must make sure it's flat. You know, it's really silly, but he just would have chucked it in, you know. Well, so, yeah, measuring is the key. A recipe is like a careful, you know, there's a careful balance. It's like a little experiment going on in your bowl. And people like me have spent a long time trying to carefully work out the proportions of every single ingredient because they're all there for a real reason. And bunging in an extra spoon of this or that can upset things. Unless you are really confident and you've made it once before and you think, okay, I know how this behaves, I'm going to put in a little ingredient and see what happens.
Well, now, let's move on to how you divided this, because this is not a usual division, I mean, of chapters. You have simple family baking, morning coffee and afternoon tea, special bakes, desserts, and after dinner. So that pretty much defines the occasion that you're going to be baking for, right? And that's how you did it.
Yeah, and I did that because I tend to think about what I'm making a cake for. I don't tend to think, oh, I really want to make a chocolate cake today. I tend to think, I've got this coffee morning with my friends from so-and-so, or it's my mum's birthday, I need to make a big cake that feeds 12 people, or I need some biscuits, or some cookies, sorry, that are going to last on the Christmas tree. I tend to think about occasions rather than exactly the kind of cake I'm going to make, and for various other reasons, that's the way the structure works. And for me, those were for beginner bakers, some quite nice cues as to recognise what to bake for that occasion. So simple family baking really is, this is the kind of thing I used to cook with my mum. You're thinking, you're stood on a stool and you're mixing the batter, and no complicated equipment, very simple techniques, simple, like tasty simple cakes and bakes, such as jelly roll and peanut butter cookies, that kind of thing. And then morning coffee, afternoon tea, that's the kind of thing that I think all brownies or yeasted buns that you can have with coffee, pull apart, make them the night before and have them for brunch, that kind of thing. That's where the thought behind that came from.
Yeah, these are not escalating in difficulty. These are just categories of occasions.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to terrify anybody by having these advancing. I mean, there are some more complicated recipes. For instance, we've got some macaron that I did with a mint flavour, so they're perfect for after dinner. I'm not going to say macaron are as easy as making a jelly roll, because they're not. But they are laid out and explained in exactly the same way, so that actually anyone could have a go at making those and could make
them. They're very
well
popular now. I just got a whole book on those.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other thing is madeleines are making a comeback.
I wanted to put madeleines in the book, but I'm afraid there's only so many pages and so much paper, and
well,
I wasn't allowed
to. There's now a whole book, which, I mean, I never even thought of some of these flavors going into it. I mean, I always think of the plain old madeleines.
We have to admit, it's not a very big book.
It's a madeleine book now.
Madeleine book's not a very big book. I have a question for you.
Yes.
When you're making a cake, do you use your book?
I do now. It's been really great, because I got my author's box of books through only a couple of weeks ago, and I've been making a few cakes lately for people, and I've actually... It's great. I've realised I've got my own personal little library. My top successes are all in one place, so I haven't got to rummage around anymore. So yes, I have done, and I've made my wedding cake. Not that it's from the book, it's something else I did, but I used my own recipe for that I wrote for somebody else. And so I often refer to my own recipes, because I know that it sounds bad, but I know I can trust them.
We believe you.
Now, in your special bakes, what are some of your favourites?
In the special bakes chapter, well, this is where we kind of think about getting a bit serious with some chocolate and Christmassy type things. So I'd say, let me think, I really enjoyed making the coconut layer cake. We don't have that cake really in Britain. We don't do that kind of big mounded, frou-frou, fluffy sort of things particularly. You might see them in some bakeries, but it's not ingrained in the British psyche, that kind of cake.
Yeah, no, I've not seen it in England.
And that was really fun to get my head round, and I've made that countless times. The frosting is made with a 7-minute frosting that you then add butter to, so it's kind of a big fluffy meringue. So that was really fun, and in the end I was totally in love with that recipe. And the sticky pear and pecan toffee cake I think is my all-time, because
yes, I agree with you, that's really a special cake. Talk a little bit about that cake. It is so gorgeous.
Well, I really like this cake because not only is it baked in a bundt tin, so bundt tins, they make any cake look spectacular, and they also cook fairly quickly in a bundt tin, and they tend to be more tender on the inside because they've been in the oven for less time. Oh, that's what I find when I make a bundt cake.
Did you see my big fat Greek wedding?
Yeah.
Did you see it with the bundt cake?
It was a long time ago that I saw it. You might have to remind me.
The very Yankee parents of the groom brought a bundt cake to the Greek parents, and they couldn't figure out what to do with it. They thought they should put flowers in the middle of it.
I love that. Yeah. Oh, well, I didn't put flowers in mine, but I could have done. I just covered mine in nuts and toffee sauce instead. I love anything with, basically, if I'm going to choose a cake for myself to eat, I tend to go for something with fruit in there. I tend to go for something with nuts in there. I tend to go for something with texture on the top, either a crumbly topping or a sticky, I kind of like lots of different textures going on at once. So that sticky pear and pecan toffee cake is perfect for me because it's sort of, and now we're getting into autumn and it's sort of the baking smell waft through the kitchen from cinnamon, and it's just that's my idea of heaven. Love that one.
I love that too. What distinguishes the desserts and afterwards?
I think it's something you can imagine the desserts of bringing out from the fridge or the cupboard and serving it with a dollop of cream or some, creme anglaise or pouring cream, that kind of thing, whereas I wouldn't necessarily bring out a cupcake or a whoopie pie for dessert myself. I would want something that's more elegant looking, that will cut into, a long, thin slice, like got a tarte citron in there, and there's a orange and almond cake. So these are more sort of more pastry based as well. We've got choux pastry explained fully, but clearly in that with some profiteroles. It's a couple of pies.
That's a coup.
I think they are quite different.
Explain that simply, because I've never been able to make it.
Choux pastry.
Yeah.
Yes. No, have a go. Have a go for me and see what you think.
Yeah, well, that's the idea of it, I think, that puts me off. It's think of that, what's the French thing where they build up all the choux pastry? The big pyramid cake?
Oh, the croquembouche.
Croquembouche.
Yes. Well, the thing for me, my motivation behind a lot of cooking is that I always feel like I can't buy decent, some things you just can't buy in the shops. And I think that often, bought profiteroles aren't just shoe buns filled with cream. Just they're never the same because they tend to go a bit soggy, don't they? So I think there's nothing like homemade choux pastry. If you can crack it, it's just perfect. It's so nice.
Your pistachio and fig biscotti look wondrous.
They're
beautiful.
Yeah. Tasty bits to finish a meal off with, but they're also quite good as gift ideas as well. Like I said earlier on, I would have had 150 recipes in this book if there were room and enough paper, but there wasn't. And I would have had a whole chapter on gifts to make and all sorts of stuff. Maybe that'll be the next one.
Now,
maybe
what
to say, how to make it to.
the next cookbook you can do.
Yes.
Well, I wish you a lot of luck on this one because it's, as I said, you set out to enable the person using the cookbook to be a success, and that's half the battle. So I really thank you for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and how's the book tour going? Is it going well?
Well, it's literally we're speaking right now. Today is the day it goes on sale. So far, I've just been on social media and doing a few interviews, and the things are going to gear up throughout the fall, so it should get quite exciting then. I think I'll be in the States.
Anyhow, so thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
And keep us in mind for your next book.
We will do. Thank you very much. Great to speak to you again.
Thank you, Jane. Bye.
Okay, take care.
Anne just suggested that I should have told you what the secret was before the interview, but I guess that you probably now know at least half of it, and the rest of it you can get if you buy a copy of the book and read it and sleep with it under your pillow and all that kind of stuff. And now we'll go to a break and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, we said that this was a baking program, but we're stretching a little bit. Our final interview is all about nuts, and it's called In a Nutshell, and it includes both baking and cooking, and tells you just about everything you ever want to know about nuts and seeds. But here we go. Kara Tannenbaum and Andrea Tutunjian are longtime friends and colleagues, and you write a blog together, is that correct?
Yes.
But it's called, your website is nutsunshelled.com. You've been teaching in the same institution, which used to be Peter Kumpf School. Isn't that funny? So long ago.
That's right.
Yes. But anyhow, what we're talking about today is something that you just naturally orbed into. A book all about cooking and baking with nuts and seeds called In a Nutshell. And It's a fascinating read. I was fascinated with all the things that I didn't know about nuts and seeds. I mean, first of all, you have a definition. What do we call a nut or a seed?
Well, a nut is really technically a seed. When we first started to do our research for this book, we realized that what we call a nut doesn't mean that botanically it is a nut, and we cast a very wide net in what we define as a nut.
Yeah, you include peanuts, for example, which are not nuts at all, yeah.
Right, they're legumes, but we included them anyway.
Right. Nuts are ancient, right?
That's right.
You list all these varieties of nuts and seeds alphabetically in the beginning of your book, and mm-hmm. one of the most absolutely amazing thing is how long people have been eating these. Now, how do you know how long people have been eating these?
Well, we see nuts as the original locavore food. Part of our interest in this, I have a background in anthropology. I used to be an archaeologist. And that sort of, in the archaeological records throughout the world, there's evidence of nut eating everywhere. And that was part of our beginning interest in this because we did a lot of research and, I sort of knew of it from my previous career, and it sort of combined the two things, and it's a worldwide phenomenon, and it really comes from the archaeological record.
Well, from a physiological and as well, I guess, a philosophical standpoint, if God had not invented nuts, then we would not have trees and many other plants.
That's correct.
So it's sort of like the Shakers, if you remember the Shakers in colonial history in the United States.
Sure.
They decided that sex was a bad thing.
Right.
So they wouldn't do it. Guess what?
So they jump up and down instead, right.
surprisingly enough, they all died off.
That's right.
How could that possibly happen? Now I'm going to.
They didn't know about Darwinian evolution, did they?
And I'm going to get this comment in by now, because otherwise I might forget. Ladies and gentlemen, listeners out on the Menu Radio, you are talking to two genuine nutcases.
You had to do that, right?
I did have to do that. Yes.
We say that all the time.
Yeah. Now, when you open your book with what is a nut, and then go through all the different nuts. Each nut, arranged alphabetically, has its own little sections: origins, forms and uses, taste, texture and appearance, care and keeping, nutrition, which is an amazing side issue here, and then something called nut extras, which has all this really interesting information that we never even could have guessed. I was astounded at Brazil nuts.
Oh, we love Brazil. Brazil nuts are one of our favorites. Well, they're all our favorites, but
pick them out of all the nut mixes, but they're really difficult, apparently, to shell and
to get the shell off, right.
Yeah, they're like three surfaces on a shell.
That's right. It's like a pyramidal almost shape, yeah.
Yeah. Now, let's just go through some of these, and just off the top of your head, just give us some odd facts that we may not know about these different nuts.
One of my favorite little fun facts is the coconut, because the husk of the coconut is useful as well. When we use coconut, we barely even, think about the outside, but the outside is as useful in the world as the inside of the coconut. When we wrote the book, we sort of eliminated so many of the, we could have written a whole book on odd facts about nuts. Dummy facts about nuts. There are tons of them. Another favorite is the sesame seed and the expression open sesame. And how when the pod that contains the sesame seeds ripens, it bursts open, and the sort of the Alibaba open sesame line comes from that.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And the one that amazed me as well is the cashews. They're poisonous, really.
Right, right, right. It's related to poison ivy. That's right.
Well,
it's filled with caustic. It has a caustic outside that can almost burn you. But what's interesting about cashews, and it's not in the book because we just read about it last week, and there was an article in the business section of the New York Times, is that the Pepsi company is looking at the liquid that's inside cashew nuts, just like they use the liquid from the inside of coconuts. And now they're trying to promote cashew water like they promote coconut water, yeah.
Now, I see, here's a conundrum here. If in fact, it's related to poison ivy and has caustic reactions, even when you touch the outside, how did we come to eat them?
You know what, that's fascinating. On that, I'm not really sure because that's not in the historical record, but somebody figured it out.
It's like the first person to eat an oyster raw.
That's right. Exactly. Somebody figured it out. I'm always amazed by that, actually, that people go, right, exactly, sacrificial lamb, Andrea. Just somebody, how many people tried to get through. I don't know. I think when you're, you know, when you're hunting and gathering and you're looking for something to eat, you're, you know, all bets are on. You try anything.
I thought one of the most interesting things we came across with nuts was about, what do they call those things? The nuts, they all come, they're always pink. The cheap ones are always pink on the outside.
Pistachios.
The red ones, they're really not red, and the, you know, the dye, I mean, I remember that from my childhood, that they were always dye red.
And you'd have it all over, that red dye all over your fingers eating.
That's right. But you never, when was the last time you saw a red pistachio nut?
Yeah, but why did they do that anyhow in the first place?
Must have been a marketing thing, and I don't really know why. I have no idea why it was done, but I remember in my childhood, like the natural ones were harder to get than the ones with the red dye.
Oh,
I
now you didn't see any red ones. Yeah. Yeah,
no, it's over. Yeah.
No, I messed up recently, but I'm not sure what. Oops, now it started again. Okay.
You got it. Okay.
I was going to ask you about. You explained pine nuts and about why they're expensive. I mean, I can picture that because they're hard to harvest.
That's right.
But the difference in price is like Peter came home with, where were they from? Portugal.
Yes.
And I didn't pay much attention. These were just for making pesto. And, what do I use? Pistachios and cilantro. Yeah, that's a good one, too. I make up all these things all the time. But anyhow, I just thought to look at the outside that had the price on the container. And I said, you spend $40-some on pine nuts?
They are so expensive. I know.
That was less than a pound.
Less than a pound.
See, I'm a good husband. I follow instructions.
I said, don't buy.
don't bring over many Chinese pine nuts.
Right.
Which are awful, pine nuts.
They are awful. I know. There's such a difference. There's an amazing difference.
Yeah. Now, we do know about macadamia nuts because we lived in Australia, and we also toured a macadamia nut plantation.
Oh, cool.
Where was it?
It was near Byron Bay, just on the border of New South Wales and Queensland.
Oh, wow.
So I knew about that, but most people just think they come from Hawaii.
Hawaii, right. Yeah. The
amazing thing was this guy had invented a machine to do automated pickup of macadamia nuts.
Uh-huh.
It was sort of almost, imagine a roller surrounded by Lego blocks.
Okay.
And the gaps, the gaps in the Lego blocks, the grooves in the Lego blocks.
I forgot
about
that.
Oh, and they picked them up.
Picked them up as you dragged it across the ground.
I thought that was funny.
You know what, there's an amazing, I mean, the problem with nuts as the most natural product is that, you know, they grow on trees and they grow under the ground and they've always been sort of, Now they're most are cultivated, but they were just harvested by people picking them up off the ground and
we were in Italy. And they were picking up chestnuts like that,
right.
Weren't they?
Oh yes, yeah, there were chestnuts all over the ground.
And all the people came out, the natives, inhabitants.
The smart ones followed the car tracks.
Yeah.
The smart ones. When they're not looking for truffles. It really is the original locavore food. Think about it. I mean, that's it. It's all about hunting and gathering, and the nuts were to be gathered, and then, you know, it.
Well, did you follow what I was saying? They followed the car tracks because at some point the car tracks ran over the chestnuts. which are a son of a bitch to get open.
They are. Or the worst are the black walnuts that people.
I'm just,
and literally drive their cars over to open them.
Well, I'm just looking at it. Aren't these black walnuts in this picture right opposite the walnut right up? Are they black walnuts?
No.
I have to look at the picture.
No, here's a test question for you. Here's a trivia question, which I'm sure you're going to know. But which American state dominates in, I think, world production of black walnuts?
Black walnuts.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
You'll never get it.
Tell me, because I don't know.
The answer is Missouri.
In Missouri?
Yeah, and there's a wonderful...
The show-me state?
There's a wonderful...
Missouri, the show-me state? I have a huge black walnut tree in my backyard, and they're just about to drop now.
Yeah, well, there's a producer of black walnuts.
Yeah, called Hammons.
Hammons.
H-A-M-M-O-N-S. So if you want to find out a lot of trivia about black walnuts, go to the Hammons.com website, and you'll be able to find out a lot about it.
Okay, good.
Well, back to this book now. So you run us through all these different nuts and seeds, and then you have a section about using the nuts, about measuring, toasting, chopping, and seasoning. And then you launch into, I think, a collection of the most fascinating, delicious, scrumptious recipes.
Thank you.
Starting with nibbles. And at the beginning of each chapter, you have nuts and bolts of whatever it is. So what are all the different categories you have? What's your favorite of these nibbles? I mean, they're so astounding. They're not your run-of-the-mill recipes.
Okay, I'm going to pass you on to Andrea, and she'll now tell you her favorites. Hold on.
Okay.
Here we go.
Hi.
Hi, Andrea.
I know I probably repeat myself endlessly on this, but my absolute favorite in the nibbles, I'm a little bit of a sweet tooth person, are the triple gingered almonds.
Oh, yes.
They are crunchy, sweet, and they have that extra little bite with the crystallized ginger, and it's really easy, and it's absolutely scrumptious. Any of the nibble nuts, and then along with the crackers, I mean, they're quick and easy to make for the most part, and they're just great to have on hand, and they don't last very long.
You see, I think that's a good idea. You explain how you could have the cracker dough ready, so that if you have somebody coming, you just whip it out.
Yep, and it's always, we also offer with a lot of our nuts and some of our crackers a cheese choice. So that what you can pair it with, so if you know that you have some company and you want to have some cheese and some nuts and some crackers, you can put out a nice little platter.
Here's another masterpiece of trivia for you. I'm a collector of trivia, just in case you're wondering.
Okay.
Which North American state produces 80% of the world's almonds?
I know that.
Oh, well, California.
I know that because she was listening in the same interview.
Well, yeah, we interviewed the Blue Diamond Company.
It's absolutely startling to imagine, though, even though California is a big state and qualified as a country in most
amazing,
parts of the world,
right?
It's still amazing.
That's worldwide dominance.
Yes,
not
yes,
it really
yes,
is.
Yeah.
Now, and almonds are one of our favorites. I mean, it's really sort of the go-to nut these days. For everything.
Well, I find that go-to not for everything now is coconut. I'm getting so sick of coconut.
Oh, well, that's true.
But, I mean, now it's...
Different type of nut.
Yeah, it's now you go around smelling like the beach suntan.
Right, coconut oil for this and...
Now, the next chapter is Dip It. And
Dip It, yes.
Yeah.
Another one of our favorites. Again, really simple, fun recipes.
Yeah, I love romesco. I mean... I found actually I can buy it jarred, which is really good.
It is. I mean, what's great about the dips is that you can, like, make a meal out of some of this stuff.
Well, you're right on target here with this section is about all the small plates and things. This is reflecting how we eat today.
Yes.
People love it.
Yep, and people don't want to eat big meals anymore. I mean, I think we've kind of gone away from that a little bit, which is nice.
What are some of the other sections? Now, I'm looking through them. Each one has its own things. The little bite section is the one that I was just talking about, which includes things like ham and cheese arugula.
Oh, I'm going to have to put Kara back on for that. Let me pass the phone back over to her. This was her creation, but it was a really good one. Hold on.
The deal with the ham and cheese arugula was that I felt compelled to sort of make it in a savory way, and they're just so good because that, you know, a typical Rogalhos dough has that richness and flakiness, and it just, it's sort of, it's, I know it's worlds colliding, but it's a terrific thing.
It is worlds colliding, that's for sure.
We believe in that. We're very cross-cultural, Andrea and me.
Well, I think the message that I want to get across is not only are you going to learn a whole bunch about nuts and seeds, but you're also going to encounter more than routine recipes. They're very creative recipes, and you can tell that professional chefs are involved in them too. And they go through mains. Noodles is another specialty in here. All the varieties of pesto. And then, of course, you have a grand finale with desserts.
Right.
And boy, those are interesting.
I know. Wait, hold on 1 second and pass you back to Andrea. Hold on.
One thing that I always wanted to say, too, is don't forget about our Morning Glory chapter.
Oh, yes, section. It would make it worthwhile getting up to have some of those morning pages.
And people always look at nuts as something to go in sweets and something that, you know, might be in a main course or like in some of the nibbles and dips that we said. But a lot of people don't think of nuts for breakfast, but they're so protein-packed, they're really a great way to start your day.
Yeah, I want this pistachio biryani.
Yes. Oh, we do, too.
See, we have the same favorites, don't we? Well, anyhow, I can only say that to our listeners that this is a book worth not only buying but actually reading cover to cover because there's that much of interest to it. It's called In a Nutshell with Cara Tannenbaum and Andrea Tutunjian. Is that right?
Yes, that's perfect.
Great. And I think that I'm going to be venturing into making some of these things. We have some guests coming over this week.
Good.
Yeah. So I was going to just give them truffled popcorn, but I might go a little further.
Well, try some of the nibbles. You'll love them.
Oh, yes. I mean, yeah. I can tell. I wish you were here to make them for me. So, anyhow, thank you, too. And let us know when your next book comes out.
Thank you so much.
And as they say, that's a wrap. Until same time, same place next week. We hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime, have a great week and
bye-bye.
I tricked you. Didn't give you the same cue as usual, but you did it anyway because you're a real professional. Sweetheart,
yes.
Enjoyed this show with you as always, and I'll enjoy being with you again next week.